Refugia, a podcast about renewal. Refugia are places of shelter where life endures in times of crisis. From out of these small sanctuaries, life re-emerges and the world is renewed. We're exploring what it means for people of faith to be people of refugia. How can we create safe places of flourishing, micro-countercultures where we gain strength and spiritual capacity to face the challenges ahead? I'm Deborah Reinstra, professor of English at Calvin University, and this is Refugia.
We have found over the last few years that our students are not only impacted by what is happening in the residence halls or in the classrooms in terms of can they see themselves in the curriculum, but also by what rhetoric and experiences that they're encountering outside the classroom, just in the media, the news, and politics in America. So we have a heightened level of anxiety. This is the post 9/11 generation, and our students really need our support and our ability to say, no, there's a place for you, and you actually are what makes this a place worth being at.
Hi, everyone. I was really lucky to get some time with the wonderful Christina Edmondson because she is in high demand for her professional expertise and her deep spiritual wisdom. I got to talk with her about the potential for college campuses to become refugia spaces and how her office helps build inclusive excellence on Calvin's campus. Christina is an experienced podcaster herself with the Truth's Table podcast, and she's a skilled and thoughtful deployer of social media platforms, so we also explore in this episode the potentials and drawbacks of virtual refugia spaces. I love what Christina has to say about discernment, accountability, and discipleship, and I think you will too. If you are a listener coming to us from the Truth's Table Sisterhood, welcome! I hope you want to dabble around in our other episodes too. Wherever you're coming from, thanks for listening. Today I'm talking with Christina Edmondson, the Dean of Intercultural Student Development at Calvin University. Christina has a PhD in counseling psychology, and she is an accomplished speaker and prophetic voice on topics such as anti-racism, inclusive excellence, and Christian leadership, among other things. She's also the host, one of the hosts, of the Truth's Table podcast. Christina is with me today to talk about creating refugia for college students, about the university setting itself, and about other spaces of cultural refugia. Hey, Christina.
Hello, hello.
I'm really honored that you welcomed me here today.
Absolutely, absolutely.
We're in your office on Calvin's campus. Tell us about the Intercultural Student Development Office. What is your work here all about?
Oh, yes. Thank you for asking that question. So my work is about serving the entire student body so that they become more aware of their own cultural identities and how God providentially has shaped that and shaped culture and their cultural identity, and but also the way in which sin impacts our cultural identities, and certainly the ways in which our sinfulness impacts our neighbors, and how that works out, right? So we want to critically discern that. We want to enjoy our cultural differences, and we also want to resist the sin that causes us to have a distorted view of self and others, and therefore a distorted view of God. So, so that's like kind of a theological nutshell of the work, and what that looks like on the ground is self-development initiatives and cultural awareness initiatives and support initiatives for students who have been historically underrepresented in higher education and specifically at Calvin College. And so I get to work with a group of really amazing, talented people who make me seem more competent than I am, and a lot of scrappy type A people, which helps my type B personality. It balances me out. But they those particular shops have a focus on either first-generation college students, international students, when we have a significant international student population, or American ethnic minority population, what we call AHANA student populations here at the college. So those are the folks that I work with.
Yeah, and we have a pretty significant international percentage here at Calvin for our size.
For sure.
Mm-hmm. How are we doing on AHANA students?
Yeah, typically, and for the last several years, our American minority numbers are typically just a touch higher than our international numbers. We are at probably about 30% non-white, non-American students, not within that kind of that collection of 30% here at the college. And so for a private institution, and certainly for a private Christian institution, we would consider those to be comparatively strong numbers. For us, we want to be representative of the country. We want to be representative of the kingdom, which is incredibly diverse in many ways. And we want to, most importantly, more so than quotas or numbers, resist any strongholds or stumbling blocks that we are institutionally upholding, intentionally or unintentionally, that make it less likely for diverse students to come and to learn in this space.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what are the most difficult challenges that our students face in trying to learn and thrive together, especially for those who feel themselves included awkwardly or not at all in the dominant campus culture? What do these students long for?
Well, you know, I think if we think about just basic human longing is around identity and inclusion and community and acceptance. So that happens on this micro level in higher education in the same way that would happen in a family system or in society. And so our students, regardless of ethnic or racial background, it's not uncommon for any student to enter into higher education with a lot of self-doubt and wanting to fit in and find their place, right? And along with find their calling, you know, this vocational idea, all of that's happening, right? And so as that is happening, we know that for students who are historically underrepresented, they are dealing with their own experiences of externalized racism, but internalized racism too at times. And they're also dealing with our what's happening institutionally for us, but in the larger ecosystem of the country or the countries, the global system. And so we have found over the last few years that our students are not only impacted by what is happening in the residence halls or in the classrooms in terms of can they see themselves in the curriculum, but also by what rhetoric and experiences that they're encountering outside the classroom, just in the media, the news, and politics in America. So we have a heightened level of anxiety. This is the post 9/11 generation, and our students really need our support and our ability to say, no, there's a place for you, and you actually are what makes this a place worth being at.
Great. So we've been talking about the idea of refugia on this podcast and translating that idea from its origin in the field of biology to more spiritual and social applications. So we've been thinking about refugia as places of shelter in a threatening or difficult context, as you were just describing, places where life persists and regrows in healthy ways and then opens out to spread and alter the surroundings. So I wonder if we could think of this office as a kind of refugium.
I would love for it to be.
Yeah. Do you see students experiencing it that way?
There are students who have talked about this office or really the people. The people in a particular space that represent that refugia for them, and which shows the power of connection to another person. I think that some of the metaphors in higher education literature about what spaces like this or in other institutions, kind of your Black Student Union or your multicultural center or whatever, people have used the kitchen table analogy. And I know that in my home, the largest table I have that seats 10 people is my kitchen dining room table. And I think of it as representing that. And as a mom, that's what I wanted to represent for my children. It's very important that I cultivate or help them to cultivate these memories of being at that table to eat together, to laugh together, to grow together, to go through our funny jokes together, to get frustrated with crossword puzzles together and puzzles of all kinds together. And I think it's an apt metaphor to describe what these types of centers are supposed to be. They're supposed to be kind of kitchen tables where the student can grow and be nourished and just be, while nearby is this person who represents some sense of stability, some lookout person. So in this metaphor, that's like mom in the kitchen making the food. And the student is able, the kid in that metaphor is able to kind of do homework and say, let me tell you about my crazy day, because there's this parent that's nearby. And things seem a bit safer. And that parent doesn't have to even interact a ton. Now, we have some students who will come near to the space to study. They ask no questions whatsoever. I mean, they may not even make a ton of eye contact. But I think it's something about the space and the sense of feeling like there's a person here who's kind of a lookout, who's made sure that it was okay, and they're maintaining some degree of like harmony and peace in the space. So I can learn and I can thrive here.
It's remarkable that it's even just the space.
Just the space.
Yeah.
Just the space.
And of course, the table metaphor has this beautiful resonance with the communion table.
Yes.
For Christians.
Yes, so, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Nice. So what are some ways that your staff and students are creating or equipping life-giving spaces that can transform the larger campus? Mm-hmm. So how does this office as a refugium then spread?
Yeah. So I think this is done in different ways. That one of the programs that pops out as soon as you ask that question, along with other ones represented in the office and just outside of my portfolio, but just throughout the college. But one of the programs is the John M. Perkins Leadership Fellows Program. And one of my staff persons who has served us for a few years now, Kaisha Likely, she helps to oversee the student development pieces of that. And that program intentionally targets first-generation college students. It's named after John Perkins and around his work on racial reconciliation and community development, so Christian Community Development Organization. And we bring together what we hope is a diverse group of students with diverse vocational interests and majors to be community to each other. And as a bit of like a their job is to be a seed that gets planted into the institution for it to grow and to ripple out and to impact the ecosystem. So
yeah, exactly.
To influence their roommates and to influence their classmates and to influence their professors.
Mm-hmm. We need it too.
Exactly, because we're always learning, right?
Yeah,
so the best professors
absolutely.
Are like always students and they're learning from their students and from everything they can get their hands on. So that comes to mind when I think about having this group of scrappy, deep well students that come to this community where it could be very easy to feel like an outsider by kind of Calvin's cultural variables, this kind of reformed theological tradition, Dutch reformed. And there are many ways in which we can feel like and be a very exclusivistic place.
Mm-hmm.
But to have these students who are in many cases first-gen students from varying backgrounds and experiences come and say, no, actually I have a purpose here.
Yeah.
And that's to season you all. It's to be salt and light in this school while I'm learning from you and I'm grateful, but also I'm here to actually impact the ecosystem. And they've rose to that challenge in a variety of ways. And so that's one student group that comes to mind, but there are other student groups likewise, and to students individually who, through their struggles and triumphs, have helped to shape the culture of the college.
Yeah, it's remarkable that here at Calvin, only 30% of our students are now reformed or from a reformed church background.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't necessarily correspond to white, but it often does.
Yeah.
And we have 30% non-white.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the numbers are less important, really, than the history and the context and the systems.
Right.
So
right.
It's not just about numbers. It's about that history and about that tradition that we're still trying to regrow.
Exactly. Well, and I think at our best, what we're doing is translation work so that we're able to see the elements of our theological tradition that the college holds to, that we're able to help students define their tradition within it.
Yeah.
In different ways, in different language.
Yeah.
You know, like, and I mean, there are traditions that are like, oh, that's not what we call it. We call it something else, but we've been talking about that for a long time. You know,
right.
Or they're able to add to it or to notice our holes and deficits, because we can be in an echo chamber and, we can't see ourselves unless we are in conversation or experience with something different. So I think that's the strength and benefit. And it also forces us to know what we really believe, because when you have people who are from a different tradition or religious identity, they press you. It's not just like, oh, this is just true because I just said it's true. They force you to tighten your belief system, to evaluate your belief system. So I'm really grateful for those students who are like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. Like, me too.
Where did you get that from?
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, let me go study. Make sure I know what I'm talking about.
So. Iron sharpens iron.
Amen, amen, amen. It's needed.
So let me quote you from an article in Comment Magazine. Here's the quotation. You wrote, Certainly, higher education creates a space for deep learning about the self, others, and the world through approaching the complex and interrelated new and old disciplines. Therefore, for many, acquiring higher education is the very folding chair that gives access to the metaphorical table. So there's that table metaphor again.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if we could expand this idea of a refugium outward to the university setting in general, where we try to work together to practice inclusive excellence. And mm-hmm. is that possible? Can we think of the university that way, or is it too big and complicated and too full of obstacles to be in its own way a refugium?
And I think we can. I think we can certainly choose to think about it that way and also acknowledge the truth about the pitfalls and roadblocks that are inherent in the ivory tower, so to speak, right, of higher education, of academia, right? So it is historically and presently, associated with a type of elitism. And yeah. I think, but that doesn't mean that we can't envision something beyond that. Mm-hmm. So I think we can hold all those truths together, the vision and hopes of what we would want it to be and awareness of where we have these stumbling blocks, and also acknowledge its history as kind of having this gatekeeping quality to it, of kind of keeping people out and keeping some people in. And, I think for me, not only because of my faith convictions, but also my cultural identity as one, as a descendant of the transatlantic slave trade, I think for many, many Africans in America, the idea of education, of being able to read, is a very big. It's very well rooted. It's been inherited through my emotional DNA, that education by any means necessary is critical. That's the access point.
Mm-hmm.
And even if not at even if not allowed at the physical table, which we know is wrong, not have the space, but to still be able to have the intellectual experience, even while being rejected from the space, is still of great value.
So I'm obviously
a strong believer in the power of education, the importance of education, and the stewardship of the mind. To be learning in very concrete, traditional ways that we think about as higher education, but to be learning about our neighbor in order to love them, in more informal, organic ways too. Mm-hmm. And I think when we think about what higher education can offer us is this exposure to these vast disciplines that really show off our God is creative and complex and condescend so that we can learn a little bit of it.
Yeah.
Right. So,
yeah.
God is so much higher than we are, but God has condescended so that we can have some, we can interact with God's creation mm-hmm. in all these different ways. And certainly with this particular theological perspective is one that calls us to engage as salt and light in every discipline possible.
Yeah.
And that if we don't show up, we've conceded ground. We're like, God has nothing to say about that. So, I think that's why we have to speak to making sure that the table is broad and that we bring in as many voices as possible so that they can help us to see the blind spots that we can't see.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if a smaller college, like Kelvin, excuse me, mm-hmm. University. Trying
Hello.
To get used to that yet. A smaller place like Kelvin, with a very firm Christian mission, it's maybe a little bit easier for us to have that as our goal, that we're a kind of refugium space
mm-hmm.
where we can very deliberately and intentionally mm-hmm. Try to shape all of campus life mm-hmm. by these values. It's harder at a larger university, maybe.
And I think, I think there's a balance between seeing ourselves as kind of this refugium space and also resisting a more kind of, I mean this in the slang vernacular sense of fundamentalist.
Yeah.
Not in the check boxes of theological orthodoxy fundamentalist.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of kind of this hunkering down, hiding place where the only thing that's good and pure is happening in this petri dish and everything out there, watch out, And
exactly.
So I think striking a balance between figuring out how to make sure that we are gracious in the way we think mm-hmm. about this space, mm-hmm. And that we have a good handle on our own sinfulness, even within the space,
yeah. Yeah.
even in the space of yeah. refuge, so to speak. Yeah. So anyway, I was as you were talking, I was thinking, you know, how do we do that well? And yeah. I think we have to always be open to being challenged about the ways that we're being sinfully exclusive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, refugia are not meant to be closed.
Exactly.
They're meant to be open and spreading.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think of that every year at commencement when we send 800 or 900 new mm-hmm. graduates out into yeah. the world.
Yes.
There we go. We're spreading.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah. It's powerful.
Like a positive fungus.
Yeah.
There you go.
Dandelion seeds.
There you go.
So besides your work on campus, you have several other jobs, apparently. One of them is to be a co-host of the podcast Truths Table, along with Michelle Higgins and Akemene Uwan. And your podcast has been going for 3 seasons, about 100 episodes, and it's so good. It's fascinating and full of rich spirituality and theology, and you address a huge variety of topics, and it's really fun.
We think it's fun.
I think it's fun, too. It's been described as a podcast that centers the voices of Black Christian women exploring faith, justice, and culture. So I wonder if you might think about the podcast as creating a refugium for mm-hmm. listeners. So tell us a little bit about the community that has formed around mm-hmm. the podcast.
Yeah. So, first and foremost, I jokingly say that it's a group therapy for us. You know, it's a space to verbalize our group texts to each other about some given topic. And we have worked hard for it to maintain kind of its organic sound. You know, it doesn't sound overly polished, I think. It's really what we would say to each other if we were connecting together in person. And we have all kinds of people who listen, though. So it's an interesting. I don't know if I want to tell people this, but I'm in charge of the emails, so they'll know that it's me responding. And from looking at the emails, I get a snapshot of where people are writing from and who they are, their own kind of ethnic and cultural identity. And, you know, first and foremost, we center the voices of Black Christian women. And we do that unapologetically. Very early on in our first season, we started to state that. We thought it was kind of implicit, but we decided to make it explicit. And that was because we were kind of getting people that were kind of pulling at us and saying, like, well, I feel like you need to explain this more, explain yourself. And we were like, no, like, we're not explaining this more. What's happening right now? This actually wasn't designed with this particular group in mind, first and foremost. And a part of the exhaustion of both racism and sexism is the distraction of it, as the late Toni Morrison would talk about. But also people feeling like you work for them. Like, so now you do this podcast, but now I need you to change your podcast to be something for me. And that's a problem. So we push back on that. Like, that's not what we're going to do, because yeah. it's our podcast. And I think what's been fascinating is that certainly I think there are Black women who resonated with that, and that gave them even greater sense of respite and like, oh, yes, I don't have to put on for someone else, right? And then I think there were people who are outside of that demographic identifier of Black women who resonate with authenticity. So they themselves are not Black women. I can think about a number of emails from white male pastors who...
kidding.
And
white male pastors are listening in.
Oh, yes. We have been quoted from many a pulpit of a variety
awesome.
Of traditions.
That's awesome.
And which tickles, which just cracks me up. Yeah. And who are attracted to the authenticity and who are grateful to be able to eavesdrop is the way they would think about it, on a conversation kind of no holds bar that doesn't center them. And they didn't realize to what extent their white maleness was being centered until they actually started listening to Truth's Table, and they were like, oh, they're actually not talking to me.
It's actually a huge relief.
Yeah.
Right. Certain ways.
Yes, I would hope so. It could be freeing, right? And so for us to see ourselves rightly as just fellow humans, I think that's actually a blessing to us. Mm-hmm. Instead of being called to always be in charge and all those things, right? And so we've gotten emails, particularly from Black women and the community that's been shaped around it, that Truth's Table has been what has helped them to stay committed to the local church or to the Christian faith. For me, that is completely worth it. As someone who considers myself kind of a highly evangelistically oriented Christian, like old school, like people need Jesus. Like I live in that lane, and that makes it worthwhile. That makes it worthwhile to do the episodes for people to say, like, I know I'm not crazy now.
Yeah.
Or I know God does care about injustice, and you're approaching it from a biblical way that's given me language. And now I feel like I can continue to engage. And so we think that that's obviously a work of the Spirit, and we want to be faithful to it. But it has created that refugium for people in the midst of a social political moment that can be described by many people as traumatizing and toxic. So we're grateful for that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what's your sense of how cultural spaces such as podcasts, which are really very new and which are more virtual, what's your sense of how they can do the work of cultural renewal in ways that are different from, say, a campus like this or a church congregation?
Yeah. Well, I think the interesting thing about a podcast, and I'm saying this as a person who's not like a podcast listener, so which is ironic. I'm on a podcast and I don't listen to podcasts a whole lot, is that there is a bit of a hidden quality to podcast listening for the good and bad. The good element of it is that people can listen in on conversations or experiences that they wouldn't give themselves permission to do for.
Yeah.
And be kind of empowered to be able to take the new insights and hopefully the deeper empathy, and then apply that in like the real actual world, the non-podcast internet world with real people. Okay,
right.
We're real people, but I'm like, go find some real people. And I think that's a real gift. Sometimes people are like, oh, you know, social media is just, it's not a real place to engage, and I disagree on some hands. I think that social media can be a bit of a classroom. Maybe this is a psychologist in me that can help you to hear at least some perspectives and to sharpen your engagement skills, right? And maybe if you kind of hang with it and you figure out kind of what is your witness in social media, your witness in whatever media form you're using, you can develop the skills to engage it in a way that is fruitful and that bears witness to Christ's work in you if you're a Christian. So all that to say is that I have found those spaces to be really interesting. It's also my way of trying to stay connected to students. I consider myself to be a young person, but I have finally reached the age of I'm at the age where I have students who can be my children.
Yes.
So, and when that happens, you're like, oh, I see. I'm a little bit older now. Mm-hmm. And I was listening to students talk about their disconnection from the church, disconnection from the faith, kind of deinstitutionalization in terms of religion. And I thought, oh, we have to figure out some alternative ways, never to replace the local church, because I'm pretty diehard about the importance of the local church, but as continued gateways. So these podcasts, these internet avenues, these spaces, at their best, help people to take a bit of a respite and then lead them back to these local church spaces.
Yeah, I love that. So it's maybe to put it in these terms, it's a place of refugia that helps you circle back into the in-person refugia where healing can happen too.
That's my hope.
Yeah.
That's my hope.
Mine too. So we haven't talked much yet about, and let's call them anti-refugia, to make up another word.
Mm-hmm.
So places where poisonous attitudes and practices are cultivated, and the world is full of spaces that cultivate and spread poison of all kinds. They're very visible right now. So how do you see the role of churches, individuals, and Christian institutions in resisting those kinds of spaces?
Yeah. Discipleship is powerful. And I think when I think about people I know who use that title as like disciplers, that is, you know, that's what we all are, first of all. But it's a high responsibility, and it's a powerful thing with the Spirit at work. And I think that that is a bit of what discipleship is doing. It is teaching people how to resist and recognize that kind of anti-refugia that you're talking about, to be able to spot it and name it for what it is, and to be able to push back on it, and to develop the Christian disciplines and the kind of life liturgy, to be grown up and strengthened, to be able to resist personal and social and systemic sin, so to speak. I had the opportunity to speak to some newer Christian higher education faculty some months back, and they were asking me, like, what do I think is, like, one of the critical issues of the moment? And I told them that I think one of our critical issues of the moment is specifically adolescent white male discipleship in this particular social political moment.
Wow.
I think that we now I could do that. I could say that for every group. Like, every group, I'm like, discipleship matters.
Yes.
But I do think it's a group that is being deeply propagandized with that kind of anti-refugia. And as people speak up more and more about kind of the construction of white identity and the system of racialization, which is a good thing, there are other people who are hearing that and not knowing what to do. And a part of their identity is being pulled away like a thread in a tapestry, and they're unraveling. And the propaganda then is there to catch them in these kind of clutches of what I would call a toxic identity, right?
Yeah.
Where you end up with, you know, the Charlottesville incident. You end up with people who feel that they are not included, and their response is this extreme self-directed or externally directed violence. And which is anti-community, right? This violence. And so I think we as a church in America ought to make it our business to be concerned about the spiritual development of people who are being propagandized. It's not only exclusively adolescent, young adult, white male, but that's what comes to mind for me. And when I think about the rhetoric around things that we would look at and call like toxic masculinity and kind of anti-immigrant, anti-sojourner, and in all the ways that those are really anti-Christ.
Yeah. Right? Anti-gospel, anti-Bible.
Exactly, the contradiction of that, but desperate for identity. And so... And I think that's part of what we help to provide for people in co-discipling or collectively discipling each other, sharpening each other, is that we are holding up mirrors and reminding each other of this identity in Christ. And I think that's a group that I'm deeply concerned that that's not.
That's so helpful as a way of thinking about combining spirituality and theology with your training in psychology in this sociological concern with identity. That's very, very helpful. I know on your podcast, two keywords that come up all the time are accountability and discernment.
That's because we need a lot of accountability.
Well, we all do. And it's really helpful to think about those two words in connection with this too. So what is your wish for Christian higher education in the next 20 years? What would you love to see?
Oh, I would love to see them as the most creative, I was going to say joyful, but I would say joyful / lamentful spaces, honest spaces, creative, honest spaces that people look to, even if they find themselves far away from this particular faith tradition, as spaces where they're like, well, that is where, you know, good, deep thinking takes place.
Yeah.
And that's where, even if I don't check all the boxes, I'm going to be treated well. And I'm going to have a space to belong in the fellowship of humanity. And that would be wonderful.
Yeah,
it would. be wonderful to me.
Fantastic vision.
And to obviously still be, you know, I want Christian higher ed to still be relevant and still exist. That's very important. And I You know, when I think about even an institution like Calvin University, we fit in really interesting spaces. As a person who's a believer who interacts with people who would be considered, for lack of better terminology, much more progressive or more conservative than I am, mm-hmm. or think of myself, I think there's an importance of having spaces that can sit with all of that, that can sit with, the importance of the essentials and the non-essentials and the charity that covers all those things. Because there's so much temptation to live within a type of polarization in which even Christian higher education is, obviously we're caught up in that too, because people want to know, like, what kind of Christian university are you? Right? And do you check this box or not that box? And, you know, where do you stand on this end? Which I'm not saying that's not important. It is. But I think even before we get to that point, the way we reach our decisions and the way that we hold each other as we reach these decisions together are actually just as important. So I'm hoping that we're a place that's still relevant, known for being charitable, and highly creative.
I love those words. Mm-hmm. I hope we can live into those. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What are the most beautiful places of Refugia for you right now, personally?
Personally? Yeesh. Oh, I love those places. So, recently I got the opportunity to host along with some of the women from Truth Table, a retreat that was sponsored by Calvin Institute for Christian Worship. And we brought together just under 20 women of African descent in the United States for a weekend retreat. And it was awesome. Now, of course, it was all the things that I would love in a retreat. But I mean, in this space, we had, arts, creative types, worship leaders, business women, academics, faculty type people all together, high powered stay at home moms. And in this space, just really kind of encouraging each other and sparing each other onto good works in the faith. And so that has been the most recent, kind of moment of like, huh, I needed that. I needed that space where no one had to explain anything to anybody. And we talked a lot about, gratitude and forgiveness and the way the gospel washes us and completes us and strengthens us. And we ate really good food, which is also really important. And this part, we ate a lot and we laughed a lot.
Yeah.
So that's a kind of concentrated space. I would say my everyday space is I find this kind of idea, refugia, in the laughter of my children.
Mm.
And reminding that some of the things that drive me crazy actually are really funny that they do.
Laughter and humor have to become two of our requirements for any refugio.
I totally agree.
And feasting.
Yes, absolutely. I totally agree. My husband's research is around Martin Luther King Jr. And that's a part of Dr. King's personality a lot of people don't know about is his humor.
Mm.
It's oftentimes like a little kind of side note in some of the major works about his life. But the humor of social activists, the humor of people who are in deep struggle or in deep suffering, is so important. And I think it's one of the unique attributes of God. I'm convinced that God has a deep sense of humor.
Oh, yes.
Thus,
so much evidence
we're here.
For that.
Yes, I'm like, we're here right now. That's pretty funny. I'm here. So those pockets of laughter have been incredibly important. And I just think brainstorming, the opportunity for collaborative work for me as a person who's kind of like high in like ideation and kind of intellectual creativity. I've had these opportunities to connect with people who we have common ground on certain things and not others, but to think about generative projects together. And for me, that is kind of this refugia. For others, that might be a burden, but for me, that's a good thing. It's a good thing.
Nice. Anything else I should be asking? Anything else you want to say?
Oh, I don't know. So as we've been talking, I've been thinking more about refugia, not so much as a place, but as a person, and what that means for us to be that point of reference for others, and knowing that Christ is ultimately that for us, right? And how that is really the source of our kind of creative germinating that gives us life to impact other spaces. So, and that is an endless supply. So that makes me very hopeful. Hopeful indeed.
That is good to remember.
Yeah, it makes me hopeful.
Christina, I'm so grateful for you and who you are and what you do on this campus and in your podcast and in your speaking and teaching and writing. I'm just grateful for who you are in the world and thankful for our time together today.
Thank you. Thank you. I enjoyed
it. Thank you.
Yeah.
This has been Refugia, a podcast about renewal. Find us on the web at refugiapodcast.com and leave us a comment. Send us your ideas about what Refugia means for you. You can also find me, Deborah Reenstra, on Facebook and Twitter at Deborah K. Reenstra.